This week on the Rugby Paper podcast, as well as unpacking all that there was to digest from England's loss against Wales and their World Cup squad, we turn our attention to defending champion South Africa and how they're shaping up for the World Cup. To help us do so, myself and the columnists are joined by World Cup winning centre and fly half Henny LaRue. Welcome back. It's the turn of the defending champions to go under the Rugby Paper podcast microscope as we continue our rundown of the leading nations as they continue their prep for the World Cup. We will, of course, also be looking at the England squad, which was announced just a couple of hours ago. South Africa announced their World Cup squad this time tomorrow as we record. So stay tuned for all of that. But first of all, joining myself, Nick Kane, Brendan Gallagher and Chris Hewitt today is a South African World Cup winning fly half and centre. In Henny LaRue. How are you, Henny?
Very good, thanks, Ollie.
Good stuff, good. Where are you calling us from?
I'm in a place that very few English people will be able to pronounce. It's called Gqeberha, but it used to be the old Port Elizabeth.
Okay, amazing. What's day to day looking for you right now? The last we sort of heard of you was your work with the South Africa Players Union in the on the rugby front.
Yes, that took me on a couple of interesting trails and was involved in founding the Players Association all the way back in 97. It was a very interesting period where there was a lot of arm wrestling with the hierarchy of the old establishment. And I think players stand a much better stand in a much better position today as a result of the players' unions across the world.
And at the moment, you are, well, we were just talking about it off air, you're involved in your own sort of, well, I refer to it as a safari park, you call it a farm. Is it a kind of one or the other, or are they kind of synonyms?
Yeah, look, South Africans usually refer it to a farm or a reserve. And we try and, breed game and do game viewing and try and run a sustainable safari business out of it.
Amazing. How long has that been going for?
I've had the property for about 26 years now.
Wow. Unbelievable. Awesome. Well, that sounds very, very interesting. Let's talk about South African rugby a little bit. Working backwards, obviously, I'd love to talk about 2019 and your experiences of 95, etc. But for the moment, I just want to ask what your makings are of the sort of Springbok trajectory ever since that World Cup win in 2019. It was obviously a bit odd. We didn't see the Springboks on a rugby field all that much in 2020 for obvious pandemic-related reasons. And then we had the Lions series and then another hiatus after then. So what have you made of the last couple of years?
Well, obviously, there's been a change with South Africa moving from the Southern Hemisphere playing in the North. I think there's quite a big adaption there. That alignment would bring about an acceptance and a change in the way rules are interpreted, in particular up North versus the way rules are interpreted down South. So from that point of view, I think on a broad base, you'd find that South Africa would have benefited out of playing certain games in the Southern Hemisphere as well as experiencing your Northern Hemisphere referees. So, the interpretation, I think, is critical. The way coaches particular parties that are technical, how the referee interprets particular aspects in play is becoming under scrutiny. There's been a enormous growth in terms of technology and so forth since 1995. So I think all bears towards more cleaner, more efficient game of rugby.
How has that corresponded with the way the Springboks have adapted their game? There was talk, maybe less so in the Rugby Championship, but in the autumn last series last year, certainly the game against Italy, for example, of a more expansive brand that was obviously built on the Springbok DNA, which you can never stray too far from. But the likes of Curtly Aronsir and Bakanyo Am, who's obviously had his injury struggles, being able to light up a field in a way that perhaps you haven't seen from recent Springbok sides.
Very much so. I think traditionally South Africa was very much about grinding the game into set pieces, creating, opportunities of set pieces and positioning themselves on the field to capitalize off that. There is a definitely under Rassie been a change to try and create a more open, expansive flow. South Africa relies very much on its defense. And that's where the open expansive game was only brought in once you're a couple of points ahead. And I think Rassie has tried to make that adaptation within the general play of South African rugby. And he probably should be commended for that.
You seem
Kenny,
to
is
see
that
history rewriting itself a little bit. I remember you as a young player being an attacking fly half. And then on the eve of the World Cup, you moved to centre and Joel Stransky came in at 10. And I mean, Joel could certainly, he had the complete game, but I saw him more as a steady Eddie at 10, a safe pair of hands, and you as a more sparky player. Is that the way you inevitably people go when you get to tournaments, when you get to big tournament rugby? You go for the slightly safer option.
Yes, it is. I think as the tournament progresses, it's all about eliminating mistakes and doing your basics really well. And if you can dominate in lineouts or you can dominate in scrums, and force those basics down and make sure that your defensive pattern is not leaking, then any team's got a chance, in a World Cup. I think the capabilities of the top six teams are all very, very similar. It's a question of executing correctly, making the right options, and getting those key game starter, positions within the game under the knee. And if you can dominate in those parts, well, then you stand a much better chance of dictating the nature of play. And I think there are nuances involved with that, which attract the ability towards creativeness if you are starting to get on top of the players. New Zealand are a team that's arguably, I don't even think it's arguably, I think it's factually correct that they just are the most consistent team, year in, year out, for years and years. And yet there comes a time where, as in a World Cup, for example, where if you get exposed in one particular concentrated area, you can expose a weakness and capitalize that. And when it's knockout, it's time to go. So these are the elements that all make the World Cup so exciting.
So the $64,000 question is, if Andre Pollard is fit, do you go with Andre Pollard as your 10 or a more attacking option as in Willemse?
Well, in both those instances, I'm a little bit concerned because, Pollard, they were talking about that he's not going to be match fit or he wouldn't have played a lot of games, by the start of the World Cup. So that to me is a concern. I think you only really start getting into a team rhythm, by game five, six, and that's one of the aspects as much as there's a good discussion to have around having two A teams. The counter argument is that two A teams that are constantly being mixed up with players becomes unsettling for the players in the sense that you don't always have that ability to read the actions of the player. The more you play with a person, the more you start reading their body language, and that body language is a critical aspect to making the right decisions in very, very short periods or short times where you need to act instinctively and react instinctively.
If it turns out not to be Pollard, Henny, who plays the lion's share of games at the World Cup, And we know from history that those tournaments come down a hell of a lot to, or can come down pretty much to goal kicking and a consistency of goal kicking. It's why the All Blacks, one of the reasons the All Blacks stick with Moonga, they don't play Bowden Barrett at 10 now, because his goal kicking is probably 10% down on Moonga's. We've seen Chesney Colby kick, we've seen Valencia kick, we've seen Faf de Klerk try it. I mean, you know, you played with Stransky, you could kick a few yourself. I mean, does that aspect of the Springbok game concern you, the consistency of goal kicking?
It does. You know, I think when you start creating this aspect of a more expansive game, you run the risk of your traditional type of fly half that has, let's call it, the ability to have an upwards of 80-85% kicking accuracy of losing that element. So that's always a gamble. And I think that's been one of France's biggest problems, not of late. They have improved their kicking significantly in the last couple of years. But previously, they didn't pay much attention to that. And I think they lost a lot of games as a result.
Mm. It seems an extraordinary thing, doesn't it? In a way, Henny, because goal kicking is a closed skill. It's one that can be practiced and practiced and practiced. And the idea that, you know, that having an attacking fly half precludes him also being an extremely good goal kicker, or having another player at fullback or somewhere else who can goal kick to, you know, 85% plus, just seems very, very strange to me. You know, particularly in a professional sport now, you would have thought that everybody's analysed the need to have a gun goal kicker, or actually you've got to have more than one.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, it remains the easiest points to score, you know, is to take your penalties and capitalize on those. In fact, in teams where both parties are, you know, the defense is very, very difficult to break through, that is the most critical factor, you know, on the field. So I'm a little bit surprised, but I assume, you know, if you have a look around, you'll find that most people can get a 65 to 70% success rate, but it's that 1-2, you know, penalties that should be knocked over that aren't, that really cause the difference. And I think it has a broader impact on that, because, you know, forwards like to grind it out and get paid for the effort. And I think to a large degree, if the forwards pick up that the kicker's not on song, it does affect you a little bit psychologically. So it is critical when decision gets made to go for poles that 80 at least percentages are there, obviously depending on the difficulty, but you should be aiming for 80 at least. Yeah.
What's the assumption, Henny, about Livock's goal kicking? I mean, he's obviously clearly a very exciting player. I've confessed my ignorance. I don't know enough about his goal kicking stats to work out what kind of marksman he is.
I don't think he meets the staff of an Ars Boeta or someone who is traditionally, you know, known for his goal kicking. But as you say, you know, I believe more money should possibly be spent on someone giving him direction on the field. And, you know, it was quite interesting. My very first tour to Australia, I came back and I was quite amused, because they, I think, had 1/15th or 1/20th of the number of players that South Africa had, and were not as consistent as New Zealand, but they were really competitive, and a lot of that came out of their academies and the way that they looked at the game outside of the field as such, and the way they applied different mechanisms to improve you know, the quality of each player. And it was a lot more driven towards the individual back then already within the teams that had limited numbers. South Africa was blessed with large numbers of players, and those players were discarded at lib, you know, for looking at someone incorrectly. But
there sounds a man who's been there by the sound of it, Henny.
We had a bit of that in England as well.
Yeah, so but the reality is, you know, those everything has changed. Everything has become a lot more professional. One doesn't need to be a scientist to recognize or realize, you know, that you go to professional sports, you learn from them, and they kind of give you some guidance and advice. And that's how, you know, the first academy started, you know, in South Africa. And you know, a lot of what we tried to do was to try and understand what Gridiron was doing, because they've been professional for years and years before rugby went professional. You know, we were under the impression in the 90s already that the referees weren't capable enough to manage the game on their own, and that it was just a question of time that the touch judges would be getting involved. You know, money's tight in the sport in many instances. How do you create more value within the sport? You create stoppages, you create advertising time, et cetera, et cetera. Gridiron, you know, taught us this in the 90s already. So these elements do all form part of this new rugby that we're living today.
Do you feel, I mean, a couple of the names mentioned, Manny Libbock and Damian Willems, sir. Do you feel that the general feeling is Libbock has emerged as the front runner should Pollard not make it? Do you feel that that's the case in the over the course of the Rugby Championship as well? Obviously, we saw them play. Libbock was at 10 and Willems are at 15, which is obviously a very legitimate way to deploy them both as well. But for that 10 shirt, you see Manny as the way to go.
At this stage, yes. Willems is got a great step and he's very, very creative. But the South African forwards are people who like consistency. They like to be set a particular goal, been set a particular path, and operating under a certain set rules, in a sense. They do deviate from that every now and then, but when the chips are down, they like to back themselves within that general, you know, form of play. So it becomes of critical importance that when you are really under pressure, that everyone can rely on the fly-half to do what is expected to do.
Is it the case? I mean, we always used to say, Henny, back in the day, that the forwards are just the piano shifters. You know, you guys were the piano players. Rugby was really all about you guys. Was there ever a point where you felt able to wander along to Osterrant or Pienaar or Ruben Kroyer and say, "Hey, guys, keep out of it. We're the artists on the field. Just give us the ball and we'll do the rest." Or were you just too scared to say that stuff?
No, we regularly told them that.
But they weren't listening.
Yeah, well, we don't, they blame their cauliflower ears on that, but we let them know either way. It's just...
It was all right. At least you had James Small to fight with them anyway, so you're okay.
Yeah, James was an enigma. He was interesting. Look, there was never a dull moment with James around. Oh, James, shame, rest in peace. He really was an interesting character.
Henny, you mentioned Francois Pienaar there, and of course, many of our listeners, their abiding memory of you is with Pienaar on your shoulders at Ellis Park. God knows how you did that after 100 minutes of rugby in the final at altitude. I mean, fantastic effort on your part. But just tell us a bit about Pienaar. 29 test matches only, 29 as captain. You knew him even, you know, before the South Africa test career. How important was his leadership in 95? And how much of an absence or a loss will it be if Siya Kolisi can't make it back next month in France?
I think, let's tuck back into Francois's role. I think his role in 95 was a critical element. You know, we had a team of very, very strong character, very strong-willed individuals who all thought their opinion mattered. And it was harnessing, you know, that group of individuals into something that we all believed in. That was critical. And, you know, Francois had a very, very difficult role to play in that. But, you know, he was also our captain within the Lions or the Transvaal side at the time. Yeah. So he had our respect and you know, he was someone who made the decisions in accordance. So from that point of view, you know, he had the support of he had adorned himself well of the task, because it's never really easy when the pressure's on and big decisions need to be made. So you know, my gesture really on the day was to kind of elevate him and thank him for his efforts.
Khaleesi, is he just as important, or I mean, he's already won one World Cup as captain, so he's already proved himself as a leader. But is it a vital role that he gets back next month, or will South Africa move on whether he can make it or not?
Look, I think you know, Siya obviously has something within the team that positions himself, you know, in the course of play, and you know, the parties obviously respect him. I'm not in the inside of the team environment to be able to call and understand and know, you know, to what extent he binds that team together. But they've had success. One has to respect that. Do I think the other open side flankers with a lot of skill and capability, should he not be available? I think South Africa are blessed with that. So as much as we hope that Siya is on for the tournament, you know, I do think we have substitutes for him.
Just as a bit of an aside, Henny, Khaleesi, we know, comes from your part of the world, from Eastern Province, I think, originally. And Eastern Province, right the way back in the day when I first went there, and way before South Africa, maybe before I went to South Africa, the Eastern Cape was well known as the big thriving area for multiracial rugby in the country. It had a real sort of foundation of cross-community rugby. Does it grieve you to see the fact that Eastern Province, or any derivative of Eastern Province, isn't right up there at the very sort of top level in URC and those big sort of cross-border tournaments?
It's heartbreaking. In fact, it's really tough, because, you know, it's the biggest province. There's probably the most number of rugby players historically coming out of the Eastern Province. But the management just didn't of the game. When there were six test unions back in the 80s and 90s, you know, Eastern Province were a very competitive side. It was amateur, and unfortunately the boys drank too much on a Friday to be really successful on a Saturday. But the reality is, you know, there were some really big names and competent and good players there. In fact, I can tell you a little story that very few people would realize, that the only cup that Eastern Province ever won, I think, was in 1991. And that was a cup that was played in the evening. And it was the only national cup that Eastern Province ever won, because it was on a Tuesday evening, because it wasn't a weekend. That tells you a good story on its own. So from a social point of view, I think, you know, the Eastern Province are front runners on the social side of things. But, it's always been, you know, a great province delivering some really good rugby players.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about the sort of feeling back home relative to 95 and 2019. And obviously the parallels were made in terms of what both meant for South Africa. And it was Francois Pienaar himself who said that 2019 was a bigger deal because you'd gone from the sort of aftermath of apartheid in 1995 to a team of all races, with obviously Khaleesi lifting that trophy. What was the reaction back home? Does it feel like a bigger deal? Obviously, maybe difficult to say as you were involved in 1995 and not in 2019, but publicly, how did it come across?
Look, I mean, when South Africa won a World Cup, they're not elements to it, in my view. You're winning the World Cup and, you know, it all counts the same. It is definitely a bigger ask. We had the privilege of running out in front of home crowds where 2007 and 2019 were away from home. So from that point of view, there's definitely a tick to say that it was a lot more difficult to achieve that. And I'd probably concur with his view on it. You know, we were carried on a wave of emotion in 95. That probably wasn't there for the 2007 to 2019 tours.
South Africa are masters at conducting a campaign, you know, three successful World Cup campaigns. It's going to be slightly different this year, is it not, in that you're going to have an almost like play two finals if you're going to win? Because that quarter final, whoever it is you play, France or New Zealand, is going to be an unbelievable, monumental match. You're going to have to peak for that match as well as 2 weeks later if you're going to win the final. Does that change the dynamic of that campaign a little bit, this year's campaign?
Look, I don't know how one changes the dynamic. You gentlemen are all in the sphere of influence there. Can you not make a plan of how the draws take place? You guys have been doing this to us for years and years. You've been placing South Africa in the group of death for the last 25 years.
Yeah, we used our influence. Henny, England have Argentina and Japan.
So, yeah, look, it is a tough ask, you know. I think to a large degree, you know, there are sides that can end up there that could very easily be the two contenders for semi-finals that are kicked out before they get there. So there is an element of head scratching around that, and I hope the authorities do have a look at it, because it would be unfair in a sense that the bounce of a ball or a penalty from a referee might, you know, preclude, you know, really good quarterfinals, semifinals, which really should be managed in a manner that the best teams get to the highest positions.
Henny, I think you'd find that everybody here would agree that the World Cup draw process, as it's been, for the last three or four, or maybe, you know, time immemorial, that the World Cup draw process is completely outdated, and that the draw has to take place much closer to the tournament, so that, you know, recent world rankings are reflected as they are in football. You know, there's no earthly reason why the World Cup draw should take place 3 years before the World Cup. It's nuts. Doesn't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, this time round, what we've got is a tournament where, as you say, you know, it's the top teams are stacked in one half of the draw, and there are large tracks of the World Cup as a consequence, where there'll be lots going on there, but there are elsewhere in other pools, there's not a great deal going on during the World Cup. You know, it's a long tournament in which, you know, there'll be a series of firecracker games quite close together on one half of the draw, but elsewhere it's rather drawn out, much too drawn out. So there's a lot. I don't know what your thoughts are as well about running a second tier tournament that, you know, either precedes and feeds into the World Cup, so that you've got the second tier tournaments are really firing you know, you take the last four semi-finalists perhaps, and they are the teams that go into the draw for the main competition. You know, there are all sorts of things. I'd be interested in your view. We sort of feel that there are all sorts of things that are not being done, that in a professional sport, and we're talking about professional now for, you know, 30 years or so, 30 years plus, you know, that need to be done.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I really would agree with that. A lot of the players, you know, there's issues surrounding player burnout and so forth as well. You cannot expect players to be playing provincial rugby, playing international rugby. There needs to be a whole streamlining effect in terms of how these competitions are put together, how, you know, players are positioned and requested to perform in particular areas to bring about a more concise or a more filtered approach in terms of the game holistically and generally. So from that point of view, an overlook of how this has turned around, I think we're ready to receive some new ideas.
One thing I wanted to ask about, which I actually asked our Irish guest, Willie Anderson, last week, was that quarterfinal. I asked him who you'd rather play. Obviously, getting through the group stages, no given at all, given that you've got to go up against Ireland and Scotland. But between New Zealand and France, who would you rather face in that quarterfinal at the moment?
It's a very, very difficult question. You know, I've got a bit of French blood in me from very, very far back, having a surname Leroux, but the French have improved their mannerisms and consistency on the field significantly. They're playing at home. They're going to be a very, very difficult team to beat. New Zealand has retained their consistency all this time. But South Africa does have a way every now and then to get under New Zealand's skin, albeit one in four or five times. But they do have that knack. France is a bit of an enigma in that you never really know what they can produce. When they are on top form, they're sublime. Then they can beat any team in the world. Then it's just one of those days that you just accept. It's a very, very difficult thing. It's half of one and six of another. It's a difficult question.
If you end up facing France in the quarterfinals, you just hope it rains, don't you? Because you beat them really easily in Durban in 95.
And that's what we found so bizarre, because, you know, Durban was extremely wet. I don't think I've ever seen a field that wet. But, you know, France are more adept to playing in the wet than the South Africans are.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't really want to see the South Africans playing in the wet. Because I think it's more advantageous to be playing, for France to be playing in the wet than South Africa.
Sure.
Penny, I always reckon that the Ruben Kruger tackle on Benghazi was the moment you won the World Cup. That was the last minute. Another 3 inches and you were gone.
Yeah, I was lucky. I was right on there. And in fact, it was James Small who was also involved in that, if I remember correctly. Because I was on the line, so I can commit to being, I think 3 inches was too much. There was probably more like one.
It was one of those sliding door moments, wasn't it? That was nearly an entirely different story that night.
Yeah, no, it was. It look, as I said, I was there, so I can confirm the outcome of where the ball was. It was, you know, and that's as close a game as what it is. You know, these World Cups today are probably even closer, just for the mere content that everyone is so skilled and on the same level. Physicality of it all is very much even in the top six sides. It's a question of how you execute and the decisions you make.
If the Springboks do end up playing France at any point, it could be in the quarter, but it could be anywhere in the knockout stage, I suppose, depending on results. But if they both put out their biggest packs, that would break a few records, wouldn't it? I mean, both countries have enormous packs, even by modern standards. They're absolutely huge.
Yeah, they are. It would be a good stat to follow up. But as we alluded to before, the game isn't won only with the forwards. You've got some artists at the back who need to perform. And we'll really be hoping that the likes of Cheslin Kolbe and Pee-Ware and, those parties will come to the fore.
Yeah. What was your impression of Kane and Moody on Saturday night, Penny?
Yeah, look, I mean,
he's quick. he is quick.
he is very quick, and you know, I'm always someone that as you get older, you kind of lean towards experience a little bit more, particularly if you're talking about a World Cup final.
Sure.
But he's got immense talent. He's got huge capability, I think the coaches are going to have some interesting decisions to make come choosing, you know, our wingers for particular games.
Has Razzie calmed down these days a little bit since the peak of his social media activities, or is he still the same Razzie who, if he sees something to moan about, he'll tell the world about it?
No, look, I think Razzie will be Razzie. He's come from a history of doing things a little differently and being creative. So, in that lies the ability to cut both ways, if you can call it that. He's not going to appeal to everyone all the time. And I think to a large degree, he has made some changes within rugby, which highlighted certain aspects. And I know, back in the, if we go back to 1995, our whole approach as a management team was very much, rugby, we play within the rules, we do what we need to do, while other parties are manipulating aspects surrounding that. I mean, we're talking about how people review television. It's become quite obvious that home game televises certain aspects where certain things happen, and when you look for that time slot when the other one's doing something wrong, they can never find it. So, that element alone, can change a World Cup. It's one small decision like that. So your television referees and how the television controls those the camera work is critical these days. And I think to keep the game fair and just amongst all the teams worldwide, they should have a standard setup. And that standard setup should be called upon at any time or any place, because there is some interesting, let's call it shaving of moments.
selective editing. Yeah.
That's the right word I was looking for.
it's a huge issue. I agree with you. I've written stuff about it, and I feel that it's almost like the regulation within the game begins to get greater and greater and greater, because you've got regulation on the pitch. Now what we're talking about is actually having somebody who is an objective, or hopefully an objective observer, in VT trucks and things like that to make sure. But then they've got to have great expertise themselves. They've really got to have been, match producers themselves to be able to detect what angles are not being shown and so on and so forth. So it's a very big issue. And I sort of think that you're right in that it's probably got to be independent panels that take home broadcasters out of the equation to a degree.
Well, theoretically, it will be in the World Cup. It's somebody doing the world feed, but of course, you've still got who is that person looking for the angles. And as you say, Nick, have they got the experience to get the right angle? And also, they're under pressure as well. You know, if it's France v South Africa and there's 82,000 at the stad and 14 million watching the TV in France, they won't be immune to that pressure, even if they're in a little box out the back of the stad.
Mm.
It'll be Sean Fitzpatrick. I can tell you now. It's a done deal.
Yeah.
Henny, one thing I wanted to ask you about that you'd alluded to with the All Blacks is consistency. And I suppose I'm mainly referring to what was displayed in the All Blacks All or Nothing Amazon Prime documentary when I say that the press expectation for the New Zealand rugby side is obviously probably about as intense as it gets. Now, New Zealand and South Africa, widely regarded as the two heavyweights, above all heavyweights in a rugby sense. And South Africa, as you've said, don't have the same consistency as New Zealand have. And I just wondered how that shaped the sort of public and press expectation when you don't get the results you'd want against Ireland and France at the back end of last year, whereby when New Zealand weren't getting the results, the knives would come out for Ian Foster in a way that they probably haven't for Ninabe.
Yeah, look, you know, it's true. South Africa, you know, lacks that consistency element and aspect. And just reverting back to this particular draw and so forth, for South Africa to consistently go and beat, you know, Ireland, France, or New Zealand, in terms of the run-up, is a major ask. South Africa like to come out and do something unique, similar to France in some ways, and probably lies between France and New Zealand when it comes to consistency, which is not great, but they do have the ability to bring about a change which other sides may find difficult to do. I think it's very much reliant on analysis and how a coach applies a particular game plan in a particular instance, and the ability to adapt. The South African approach to rugby in the past has been very, let's call it, one-dimensional in a sense. And they seem to be a lot more comfortable with that. And if you're playing two top sides or three top sides in a matter of 3 weekends in going towards the final, you know, to adapt to different styles of play because you're playing different opposition, different strengths, may take its toll in our inability to adapt to let's call it the type of game plan that's required.
I've just got one more thing to ask you, but before we do, let's do your random rugby 15, which is the quick fire question section about sort of you and your career, if that works for you. Yeah, all good?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, we'll get into it. Nickname?
Hen, that's the cackling one, or Spike?
Spike. Nice. Best rugby memory?
Obviously the Rugby World Cup final. But then there was a great moment at Newlands scoring against England.
Most embarrassing rugby memory?
In a Springbok jersey, playing a midweek game in a very wet field against, I'd prefer to, and let me rather say I can't remember the team we played against, but I slipped and missed a kick in front of the poles.
Nice. Pre-game tune.
Sorry?
what would you listen to before a game, pre-game tune?
You know that I've never done music before a game, interestingly. It's I've always liked looking into people's eyes and just seeing if they're bleeding or crying.
Post-game meal.
Probably a good steak.
Nice. Best player you've played against?
Sure. I mean, they're hordes of them. My word. You know, if you're talking about opposing numbers, you got Horan, Bunce. You know, internationally staged. You know, those were kind of players. You know, Daniel Carter was good. Really good. And look, there's a host of great players that I can call on.
Best player you've played with?
Probably Donny Heber.
Favorite player right now?
I think the excitement of Chesson Colby is probably would trigger me on to answering that question.
Rugby idol.
Oh, that's goodness, that's a difficult one. Let's call it. Could we come back to that one?
Yeah, I'll come back to it at the end. Favorite stadium?
Ellis Park.
Favorite gym exercise?
Probably bench press.
Had that one. Willie Anderson said that as well. Occupation if rugby didn't exist?
Game farming.
Superstitions.
Except for the pay.
Yeah. Superstitions.
I always used to tie my socks up to the outside of my leg.
Oh, why? I see.
You know, you had these little strings on the inside of your socks, and those. Now I'm taking you back. You see, I'm really taking you back to our days.
Rugby law you would change?
I think it'll probably be, and it seems as if it's moving in the right direction, but what really got to me a little is the refereeing around yellow cards and red cards when it wasn't really taking into consideration the intent of the player. And it was just a blatant call without, and I must say it is starting to change, which I'm very pleased about. You know, my opinion, a seatbelt tackle when you've got no other option or someone's bearing down on you like a mole, knee height, you know, how do you stop someone like that without, you know, doing a seatbelt tackle? I mean, it's virtually impossible. So there needs to be some refining around that. And I think the refereeing needs to adjudicate the sense of intent rather than the actual action, because you are going to have instances where, you know, an action really looks bad, but it's as no result of the intent.
Yeah. Very fair. And last thing, best thing about working in rugby?
Oh, it's just meeting people like yourself and yourselves and being in a position to expand your horizons and exchanging thoughts and the social aspect of it. You know, it's a privilege to have had the honor of doing what we do and still having the ability to mingle with people who are like-minded, enjoy similar things and share, you know, a chat around them.
And
could I just ask you very quickly? Oh, sorry, Ollie, go on.
No, we're just to round it off. I was going to ask for Henny's rugby idol, if he's got one.
Look, I mean, I must say, you know, when your idols are formed when you're of a particular age. And I remember, you know, the full back line of the Springbok team on what would be remembered as the Flower Bomb Tour in New Zealand.
81.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, you had Serfontein, Boerter, Duplessis, Gerber, Kermesis, Ray Mort, and Jan Hennis. You know, it's a grouping more than anything else. That back line was quite unique. you know, idols, you know, as far as they go, we're all human. It's difficult to idolize any particular person.
I was just going to ask you, Henny, you mentioned Danny Gerber, and I remember seeing him, I suppose, as a youngish bloke in 84 when England toured in 1984, and he was just sensational. And for reasons way beyond anything to do with Danny, we didn't see anywhere near him much. I mean, I don't know how many tests he played, but it wouldn't have been that many. Can you just give us an idea of how good he was? Because to my way of thinking, he might have been the best 13 I ever saw.
Yeah, there are very few that would come. He just had a different knack to him. You know, he had the ball skills. He could, you know, play centre kicking relatively easy. His explosiveness off the mark was something exceptional. You know, there are very few people that could beat him over 20, 25 yards. He was just in a different level. And, you know, I've seen him take the ball, pass it onto the wing, and then run around the wing and take the ball on the outside and go and score, you know. So his ability on the attack was something exceptional. And, you know, in a day that was amateur, you know, if he was given the opportunity to play more rugby, I think his records would be still standing today.
Henny, just before I let you go, I'm going to ask you to get out your crystal ball. And we've had a few predictions so far, looking at nations gone by. I think Willie Anderson said that Ireland were getting to a quarterfinal, maybe a semi-final. Last week, where do you see South Africa getting to, both head and heart combined?
I'd like to see them get to the final, but semis is probably where they might get to. Yeah.
So you see them winning that quarterfinal against, well, probably one of New Zealand or France.
It's quite possible. I'm hoping that becomes their game of differentiation, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
But whether they can do it the following weekend is really the challenge. Mind you, you know, who they will be playing against is at that stage might enable them to go through. But I don't know if South Africa has the ability to pull off three weekends, one after the next.
Yeah.
Against, you know, the top four sides in the world.
Yeah, well, it's effectively three World Cup finals in the space of 3 weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we're a little thin in one or two positions in terms of experience and real capability in terms of settling and changing and adapting the type of play. But, yeah, look, I mean... I don't think one should ever write us off, and I'm hoping to see us go all the way through.
Awesome stuff. Well, Henny, I'll let you go. It's been absolutely fantastic meeting you. And yeah, thank you so much for dropping by, and hopefully maybe see you down the road at some point. But yeah, it's been great meeting you, and all the best.
Super. Thanks very much, Nick, Brendan, Chris, Ollie. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Henny.
Thanks, Henny. Take care.
Thank you.
Watch out. Bye.
Okay, at the time of recording, I think I said earlier it's 2 p.m. on Monday, so the England World Cup squad was announced about 4 hours ago. The rumours were last night that Henry Slade was being omitted, and that has turned out to indeed be the case, which is probably the biggest headline of all of them. Let's give our thoughts, guys, just 10, 15 minutes or so on that World Cup squad. Brendan, I'll come to you. Is Slade the biggest sort of notable element of that squad for you?
Yes, I would say it probably is. It's one of those ones, it's not entirely a surprise. I think we've all said before that perhaps Henry Slade is not producing the goods for England like we'd hoped he would. I mean, I thought he was going to be one of the great England talents when he first came on the scene. So I think his place was a bit more in danger than we thought. What surprises me is, in that case, why wasn't he given 80 minutes on Saturday? If it was that close, You know, we haven't seen much of his Slade, have we, recently? So why not give him, you know, he's served England very well. Why not give him 80 minutes to state his case? I think I've got a slight theory about him. It's all to do with the predominance of Owen Farrell when he's in the team. When Owen Farrell's in the team, whether it be at 10 or 12, Owen Farrell runs the show. And it's very difficult if you're the other creative back to sort of, you know, there's not a lot of oxygen. I remember when Danny Cipriani got that start in South Africa in 2018, everything from Ben Youngs to Owen Farrell. Danny might as well not have been playing. And I sometimes think that Slade at 13, but he's a very creative 13, very good kicker, great hands. But when Owen Farrell's running the show, he's almost redundant sometimes. And he's done well on occasions to find a way into the game. But, it, you know, there's it's almost stifling sometimes. Great player that he is, Owen Farrell, that the creative instincts outside him don't always get a full shout. So, yeah, that's the big one. The other ones were all sort of 50-50 shouts. It's funny that Don Branch would play all six matches under Borthwick during the Six Nations and around, and then not even get in the squad. But he hasn't really taken his chance, to be absolutely fair. And it was a very funny back row on Saturday. You had a number eight and two number sixes.
I mean, just on the Slade thing. I agree with Bren about the Farrell thing. I just wonder whether this is a little signal that Farrell's going to end up at 12, you know, and they'll play the Stampeder at 13, be it Tuilagi or Lawrence or whoever, because it seems. I don't know. I mean, it's just a bit of a guess, because it's a big step. It's by far the biggest step that Borthwick's made in terms of leaving somebody out. I think that's true, because Slade's been he's played a lot of rugby for England, hasn't he? And you know, he's held in very high regard in a lot of quarters. I mean, my long held idea that he would have been a hell of a 12 if he'd ever played there, not just for England, but also for Exeter. He never got a run there. They always played a basher at 12 and used him as the creative presence one out. But I just wonder whether Borthwick is going to go back towards a forward game management type of thing and play him and Farrell, which did get England to the World Cup final in 2019. I'd throw that out there for discussion.
The overall, you know, one of the biggest observations that I have is that if you just, I threw forward towards the Argentina game and tried to pick a likely team out of this. And interestingly, I've got Ford Farrell as the 10-12 combination in it. And if you look at the starting 15, certainly, almost every permutation will give you that 12 out of the 15 are from the 2019 World Cup squad. And then the question that you have to ask yourself is, are any of those players better players now than they were in 2019? Or have they actually slipped off a fair way? So it sort of shows you the conundrums that are there with this squad. I mean, Billy Vunipola, I accept that, you know, Ben Earl can play number eight at a push. I accept that Ludlam can play number eight at a push, but neither of them, when it comes to the first choice number eight at their club sides, they're not it. So why they're suddenly going to be able to cut it at number eight at international level in a specialist position with a wobbly scrum base, which is what England have definitely got, sort of fills me with dread in some ways. And then I also look at the fact that Billy Vunipola now seems to be the only specialist number eight in a 33-man squad.
So can anyone explain to me, in words of one syllable, because I'm thick, can anyone explain to me, if you're going to do this, unless the Borthwick decided to do this last night, if you're going to do this, why would you get rid... If you're going to get rid of Don Brant and Tom Willis, if there's any possibility that you're going to get rid of them both, why would you have got rid of Zach Mercer at such an early stage?
Yeah.
Why on earth? It makes no sense to me at all.
All of the above. But also, you know, what you're also looking at is a number of players coming into this squad who, I mean, we don't know, I don't know, certainly, what element in the actual training, the fitness training, they have played, because they have been recovering from injuries. So Ollie Chessam's one, Billy Vunipola's another, and there are, you know, there are others throughout the team. But Billy is the one who concerns me most, because every time I've seen him come back from injury, I would say he takes at least 3 weeks, the best part of a month, to get close to being up to running speed again. And, you know, we're going into a World Cup. Maybe he'll, if he manages to play the next three games, maybe he'll be just about there. But I don't know what standard of fitness he's starting from. And the same with Ollie Chessam. You know, so there are so many sort of conundrums here. I thought, incidentally, you know, my favorite hobby horse, the scrum, I felt that England were totally unconvincing against a novice Wales side, an experimental Wales side. I thought that they were lucky to get the scrum penalties that they got, or not. It was probably a 50-50 split against two novice Welsh props. And when they made the scrummaging changes in the second half, and the old Red Rose Henry Thomas came on for Wales, England, they made a mess of England. Total mess. So, you know, Borthwick's playing, looking as if he wants to play a kicking game, which is predicated on having a very strong pack. Well, at the moment, there are no signs of that very strong pack.
It's actually been a very good summer to be injured, isn't it? Billy Vunipola, Billy Walker, Ollie Lawrence, Chessam. You know, there's no form there. The current form. We don't know what the fitness is. Billy hasn't played Test rugby for 2.5 years. I mean, now he was in good nick for Saracens when he got injured. That's a long, long way away, a long time away from the international arena. And as discussed ad infinitum, for most of us, that Zach Mercer was that man from a long way out. So there's some confusing thought processes there, I think. But, you know, also it's very Leicester and Saracen centric, isn't it?
It is, Brent. I agree with that. I mean, one of the biggest concerns, or an additional concern, is the scrum halves. You know, the pace of England's game against Wales on Saturday was treacle slow again. And we've got, you know, we've got young, quick scrum halves who are not getting a look in. And we've got two veterans. And Danny, you know, I mean, look, they've both been fine players, you know, outstanding players in many respects, but both of them had relatively average, well, they had average seasons last season. You know, neither of them set the world afire at all. So the idea that a guy like Mitchell or Quirk, that there is not space for them, or Spencer, is just, it's mind-boggling, really.
I watched those games. You know, I had a real day of it on Saturday. I watched a whole chunk of those games. And to see the England-Wales game directly after Scotland-France, and I know these are warm-up games and there's loads of ifs, buts and maybes and strange things that you can that you can apply to warm-up matches. But the whole tempo, the whole nature of the England-Wales game seemed as though it was out of the cave compared to Scotland and France in terms of its tempo, in terms of its scope, its level of imagination, its dynamism. And that was a France side, you leave Cameron Wachey aside, who's coming back from injury. They didn't have a single first-choice player on the pitch. Not one. Scotland were almost at full strength. So the Scots may have, you know, they may not be too jubilant, actually, when they look at it in the cold light of the day. But just as a spectacle, just in the way the game was played, the way the game was approached, it was far, far quicker and more dynamic than anything that was happening in Cardiff. And I think that's a concern.
You know, I mean, it's concerning, and it's concerning. I mean, I don't know whether, I don't believe that, I think Steve Borthwick meant what he said when he said that he wanted England to play at pace, with pace. It's one of his main tenets. He wanted them to, you know, to raise the tempo of the game significantly. And there's absolutely no sign of it at all. There was no sign of it in the Six Nations, and there's still no sign of it. So we'll see on Saturday at Twickenham whether, you know, finally we do see something like, you know, that sort of transformation. But at the moment, it looks very unlikely.
I know that it was a massive bonus for Wales, wasn't it? I mean, an unexpected one, I think. Because if you've been Lee Harpenny or George North, who were the two blokes with a lot of caps, leaving Bigger aside because he wasn't starting the game, but two blokes with loads of caps, Gareth Davis, I suppose, as well, but he's no longer an automatic first choice. If you've been sitting in the changing room looking around, you know, those blokes looking around at two kids at prop and two second rows that, you know, haven't been around that long and a debutante in the centre and Rio Dyer on the wing and all that, you might have thought, crikey, if this goes wrong for us, it could go wrong in a really big way. We could be on the wrong end of plenty here. And they weren't. It's a massive bonus for Wales, just in terms of their confidence, team building confidence. It'd be very interesting to see how well they play on Saturday, actually, if they can build on that, because I think it was an unexpected bonus for them at the weekend and a big missed chance for England.
Meanwhile, can anybody tell me what was happening with Caden Murley last week? Dropped from the squad, brought into the squad, back into the squad, not in the 23 on Saturday, no attempt to even give him game time, and then dropped from the squad again. I mean, what's all that about?
Maybe he went out on a Friday night like Henny LaRue's old mates at Eastern Province. I don't know. Who knows? I mean,
it
was a strange episode.
Syndrome. Yeah.
It was a strange episode.
Well, we're worryingly strange. You know, because the one thing you get from both that you normally think is logical, steady thinking. And that was just bonkers.
Yeah. It was very old. I'm not wholly, you know, bereft of well, I wouldn't say I was optimistic, but I mean, some of the things in the squad are okay. I mean, I think Joe Marchant, for example, is well worth a place. I think he's a good player who does have a couple of points of difference. And he played very well on Saturday, you know, by England's standards. He played pretty well. I think he's worth his place. But I just don't know. I can't quite pick the sort of process of the thinking in terms of this, in terms of this selection. I don't know when the selection was made, really. I don't know when the shape of the squad really occurred to the coaches. I don't know how much onus they put on Saturday's performances. I find it all a bit of a mystery.
We can only conclude quite a bit, because a lot of those who did play on Saturday didn't come through.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
With the Henry Slade thing, also, it strikes me that with a 19-14 split, isn't it, there is a, you know, an emphasis or a premium on utility in the backs. Well, Henry Slade, you know, he can play 10, 13 and probably 12. I would have thought that might have boosted his usefulness, but apparently not.
Yeah, that was peculiar to me, the versatility thing, because I think Henry Slade could feasibly do a job at any position from 10 outwards, whereas you couldn't say the wingers that have been picked, or obviously for the other 10s that have been picked. We're going to have to wrap up in a second, guys, but I've just got one quick question for you all. So roughly a month and a half, 2 months ago, we picked our England 15 for the 2023 World Cup. I have got the starting 15 we picked in front of me.
This is going to be awful.
How many of those do you think are not even in the World Cup squad?
Well, with my track record, all of them.
Alex Mitchell. I think we all went for Alex Mitchell, didn't we?
Alex Mitchell's one.
Zach
Mercer's another.
Did I pick in Tom Pearson or not?
No, didn't pick either of them. No, but one of them's a winger.
Oh, Johnny May?
No, we didn't pick Johnny May.
Talking of Seager?
Yeah.
Was he?
Big Joe, not in that. There are two more. And, well, one of them.
Hooker?
I mean, no, Henry Slade.
Henry Slade.
Obviously. And then our tight head prop, which was the Jersey Cow.
Oh, Rapava Ruskin.
And Rapava Ruskin. Well, we were kind of like, we couldn't really decide on one, so we went with the Jersey Cow eventually. But Rapava Ruskin was the only plausible rugby player. But we're already at a 67% success rate, and that's even before the tournament has begun. So...
Yeah, well, thanks for pointing that out, Ollie.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's all good. It's good. I'm harming my future more than your own. Don't you worry.
Well, we'll make sure of that.
Yeah, we'll be on board that bandwagon.
Well, don't worry. We're 76 episodes in. I think that's well and truly done. Okay, guys, we'll wrap up there. Next week, we'll be turning our attention to Wales. So tune in for that, and I look forward to seeing you men then.
Yeah, good stuff.
What on team.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Rugby Paper Podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whichever podcast platform you use and recommend the show to your friends. The Rugby Paper is available to buy every Sunday. And to make sure you don't miss it, subscribe through our print, digital and online options at therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions. That's therugbypaper.co.uk/subscriptions to get all our content for as little as 14p per day.